to order. For your information, there are three bills scheduled for today that we're not going to do. 2018, 2108, and 3019. So if you're here on behalf of any of those particular measures, you can take an early weekend, from my point of view anyway. And with that, we'll open a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 35. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, HJM 35 is a memorial that urges Congress to pass legislation declaring farm trucks as operating in intrastate commerce when within 150 miles of a home farm, unless the truck is operated as a for-hire carrier for farm products.
Thank you. Tammy?
Yes.
I didn't expect you to be here today.
Come
on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tabby Denny. I am the executive director of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. We are a grassroots trade association located in Pendleton, Oregon. But I'm here today to speak on behalf of the House Joint Memorial, number 35. In the 2003 legislative session, the Oregon farm community lost their longstanding exemption in the Oregon revised statutes from safety regulation when operating their trucks in interstate commerce. This occurred in response to a federal audit in which USDOT determined the farm exemption was a disqualifying circumstance that would preclude Oregon from continuing to receive the Motor Carrier Safety federal grant of $4.6 million every biennium. Oregon Speaker of the House Karen Menes was very involved in the discussions between the farm community, Oregon Department of Transportation, and U.S. Department of Transportation. At the end of the 2003 session, an agreement was struck whereby ODOT safety regulatory staff would work very closely with the Oregon Wheat Growers League and the Oregon Farm Bureau staff to keep us fully apprised of any proposed or actual changes in the safety regulatory environment. The basis of the farm community's acquiescence to the statutory revision in the 2003 session that removed our long-standing safety exemption was the assurance that ODOT would direct the work of the law enforcement agencies in Oregon aimed at truck safety regulation. This is now reflected in ORS 825.248(2). At the conclusion of the 03 session, the Oregon Wheat Growers League, Farm Bureau, and Oregon Association of Nurseries, together with the Office of Federal Motor Carrier Safety and ODOT, worked collaboratively to craft a handbook, which I've given you a copy of. We distributed, each of our associations distributed copies to our respective memberships to assist our growers in better understanding the very lengthy and technical regulations pertinent to interstate and intrastate commerce. The handbooks were developed as a proactive means of educating our producers so that they could comply. The goal was to give them layman's terms so that they would be able to easily comprehend and be able to visualize that compliance standard. Our growers responded to the receipt of these handbooks and began to immediately request their USDOT numbers for display on their trucks. The majority of Oregon's wheat producers haul their own grain to the local upcountry or terminal elevator or to the local flour mill. The irony in all of this is that if they move their grain from the field to the local flour mill, it is deemed intrastate commerce, governed by Oregon Department of Transportation. If the same grower using the same vehicle transports his or her grain to the local terminal elevator for export, that is deemed interstate commerce, governed by U.S. Department of Transportation. This is because the final destination of the grain is unknown, and it has been determined that grain with where the final or any commodity where the final destination is unknown to be deemed interstate commerce by the Interstate Commerce Commission years ago. So, as you can see, our growers are sort of trapped in this bureaucratic nightmare. As mentioned earlier, upon receipt of these handbooks, many of our farmers applied for and received USDOT numbers to be displayed on their trucks. Part of that requirement or part of the protocol is that after receipt of the number, the grower then is notified that they will need to submit to a new entrant motor carrier interview. In the letter that they received, it's termed an audit, and in the hearts of every grower is stricken much fear by the words audit, and for any of us, actually. The irony in this is that farm operations that have been running trucks for three decades or more are deemed new entrants simply because they've never had a USDOT number before. Our members have found these interviews to be burdensome, time-consuming, and nearly impossible to prepare for or to comply with. The handbook collaborated on by ODOT and the local Federal Motor Carrier's Office clearly states that qualified growers can self-certify the mechanical condition of their trucks as long as they are not hauling in a for-hire status. Since the printing of these handbooks, USDOT officials here in Salem have indicated the self-certification language does not meet their standard for legal sufficiency. With regard to the demonstration of competency of the farmer to do their own mechanical work, resulting in an immediate audit deficiency for our producers. Following the truck safety audit, growers receive a letter, yet another letter, from USDOT, Washington, D.C. office, advising them of the deficiencies noted during the inspection. The most common is the self-certification, which is not accepted by USDOT. Another area of concern is the requirement for growers to obtain a medical card. Growers hauling strictly in intrastate commerce to the flour mill are not required to possess a medical card. Growers hauling their grain in interstate commerce are being advised by the inspectors that they must also maintain a daily logbook, and their drivers must meet an age threshold of 21 years. Neither of these requirements applies to growers hauling their goods in intrastate commerce. This past February, members of my board of directors attended a National Association of Wheat Growers conference with 23 other state representatives. And while we were all convened in that one venue, they began to conduct their own informal survey asking growers from these other 23 states whether or not they were being held to the same standard of requesting USDOT numbers. And it was interesting to note that not one grower in that conference even had an inkling of what our growers were speaking about. That fact was painfully evident to former Federal Motor Carriers Administrator Julie Carrillo, who actually asked her staff to perform a national check of where the federal safety regulations were not being enforced against farmers across the country. In essence, it seems to be the case that farmers in Oregon are being held to a higher standard here than anywhere else in the country. The OWGL believes it to be unfair that these safety regulations are being unevenly enforced across the United States, placing Oregon farmers at a competitive disadvantage. Oregon's economy, as you know, is dependent upon the success of its ag producers. House Joint Memorial 35 urges Congress to pass a law declaring farm trucks as operating in intrastate commerce within 150 miles of their home farm in a not-for-hire status. This action would free Oregon farmers from undue regulatory barriers not currently enforced in the rest of the United States. The Oregon Wheat Growers League therefore respectfully urges the passage of House Joint Memorial 35. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I now welcome your questions.
Thanks, Tammy. Questions? Yes, Representative Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why 150 miles?
That's the statutory language. Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, that is the statutory language that is referenced within USDOT statutory language. That's not a number that we have identified as our own. There are two different numbers. There's 150 ground miles or 150 air miles, two different thresholds that are found in the different regulatory manuals that we tried to boil down to make it more in a simplified format for our growers.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your last comment about that the regulations were not being enforced the same in other states, and when you did this, why didn't you add, I guess, something to address that, to say that we feel like, you know, at the very least you should be enforcing everybody the same and not picking out certain states to be stricter with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, members of the committee, it's been an interesting roller coaster ride as we've tried to get our arms around this interstate commerce matter, which seems to have captured the wheat industry more directly than it has some of the other commodity industries in our state. The interstate commerce matter applies to all commodities where the form of the commodity doesn't change at the point of delivery. So that is why the intrastate commerce threshold applies to the flour mill deliveries versus the elevator deliveries. The issue of fairness is what we are attempting to call your attention to in urging you to pass the House Joint Memorial. We realize that it is nearly insurmountable for us to ask for a change in interstate commerce regulations. But to ask for an exemption and place all of our growers on the same playing field for farm truck safety regulations, so that we're not asking for freedom of the farm truck safety burden, we're just simply asking that it be unilateral, intra versus interstate commerce, so that growers, if they meet the intrastate commerce threshold for safety, then that would be an acceptable threshold. And as far as asking for fairness state to state, what we don't want to do is, we certainly don't want to create additional regulatory burdens for our neighboring growers in other states. We simply want the regulations to be we want to be treated the same uniformly in Oregon as we have been able to discover that growers are being given the opportunity to function at that intrastate threshold irrespective of commodity in other states. Does that answer your question?
Representative Burley.
Thank you. I'm still trying to understand kind of the sequence of events here. So the federal motor carrier safety rules right now say that if you're operating within 150 air miles, you're exempt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, the only...
And the reason I ask that is because in the House Joint Memorial on lines 22 and 23, it says, whereas current federal regulations exempt farm vehicle drivers from requirements when operating within 100 to 150 air miles from the farm or commodity distribution point. So the regulations currently have this exemption in there. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be correct for intrastate commerce. So we're asking for the exemption to apply to growers functioning in interstate commerce as well.
Well,
that's what we have intended to accomplish through this request.
Okay, well, and I, the current federal regulations exemption, though, is it specific on inter versus intra? I mean, or does it just say if you're operating a farm vehicle within 150 air miles, then you're considered to be intrastate? Is that basically what the regulations say now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, it's my understanding that that would be accurate, yes.
Okay. But then the Interstate Commerce Commission at some point in time in their infinite wisdom, made this determination that since you're taking this to a grain elevator, and who knows where it's going from there, they're going to designate it as being interstate commerce. And so basically the ICC is overruling the existing federal regulations. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, that would be an accurate assessment. This is a decades-old issue that when we were first as an industry faced with, we gathered a group of knowledgeable producers together who had been experiencing this added oversight by USDOT officials at the elevator. We felt that that was to be an error, and we challenged it. We gathered them together, took them to Washington, D.C., met with USDOT officials, met with members of Congress, asked for some intervention. We were basically told that ICC ruling would stand and the matter was not to be addressed as far as a change, a specific change to interstate commerce law.
I completely sympathize with the issue because, you know, the increased burdens of being regulated under the interstate the rules, but I guess where I'm going with this is, would it be more preferable that you just got rid of the 150 air miles and say if you're operating a farm vehicle within the state lines, it's intrastate, because that by definition is how all the other commodity haulers are regulated. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not certain that I'm expert enough to be able to answer that question with any kind of authority. It would be the preference of my growers, whom I represent, that if we could lift a radius, an air mile threshold, and make it, as you say, within the confines of the state boundaries, my growers would be very pleased with that kind of ability to move their commodity as intrastate commerce. However, I'm not certain that we might not meet more objection from USDOT officials if we attempted to modify language that somehow they would see as being us trying to trump their authority or ask for a revisitation of the definition, the very defining of intra versus inter.
That might be a tougher road to home.
This has been a horrible discussion for us and ongoing, as Representative Hunt can attest to. We've engaged him in several conversations, and we've also served with Representative Krupp in the last session on a special committee to try and address this matter prior to the action taken during the last session to try and make certain that there was not going to be any new or undue burden placed upon these growers.
Further questions? Tammy, the 150 miles, does that take care of most of your growers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually, given the size of the state, it does not. But again, it would be the issue of whether or not USDOT may want to oppose us in this very request, even though this is not does not carry the weight of law, as we all know. But even, you know, at the congressional level, they may really create some more pushback if we tried to ask for a redefinition of that that boundary or that distance.
Further questions?
I just have a comment. Just, I feel your pain. Things like this just drive me nuts, and I'm definitely a full support here. So
that's why, if you look at the record, you'll see I was a no vote on this bill in 2003. I know we had to do it, but I still don't like it. I think it's, and it has to do with definition. It's really about definitions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I really appreciate your support. This has been, as you can well imagine, incredibly frustrating for growers who are simply trying to make a living and moving their commodity from their field to the delivery point. In their opinion, they are maintaining their trucks in a safe operating manner, and they have no objection to that. They want to operate their vehicles safely. They certainly do not want to be behind the wheel themselves of a vehicle that is unsafe or put anyone in harm's way that is driving their vehicles or who may be on the road at the same time their vehicles are running. So for them to be captured by this bureaucracy of where are you being stopped and then asked what seems to be a fairly benign question of where are you taking this? Are you going to the elevator? Are you going to the flour mill? And then being captured by the answer And if the answer is, I'm going to the elevator, then the outcome is very different than if they simply reply with, I'm going to the flour mill. So that has been incredibly difficult for growers to comprehend. They really believed that they were doing the right thing by reading through these manuals, complying with them, and then finding out after the fact that this is not enough information for them. And even if they hand this to the officer who may have them stopped, it still is not sufficient to provide them any kind of barrier from that added oversight and that added scrutiny, which has been very difficult for growers to understand or appreciate.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Boone.
Maybe I missed it in your testimony, but have you talk to your federal representatives and senators.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have been in lengthy conversations with both of our senators. In fact, Senator Smith and Senator Wyden are considering signing a letter jointly to the Federal Commerce Committee asking for this same exemption. We're concerned at this point in time whether or not there is an opportunity for just creating more scrutiny as far as the regulatory burden or the regulatory enforcement that may not be currently carried out in other states. So are we going to shed the light on something that Oregon farmers are enduring this added burden, other growers in other states are not? Now we want to ask for added enforcement in all of these other states rather than decreased enforcement in Oregon, where we just level it to intrastate commerce thresholds. So, yes, we have been in lengthy conversations. In fact, when we first took that delegation back to Washington, D.C. about 5 or 6 years ago, we met with Senator Smith and Senator Wyden. We've met with Congressman Walden and his staff repeatedly. So all of the members of our congressional delegation have been apprised of this situation. It's the 800-pound gorilla. Interstate commerce is something that appears to be the third rail where we just really don't want to go in at the federal level. And we can understand with homeland security issues that we don't want to disrupt interstate commerce or ask for a new definition of interstate. We just really want to bring it down where growers can comply with intrastate commerce regs and call it good.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Don Schellenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I had the privilege of meeting Emily Hunt and watching her write. Cat, mom, very good for being 5 years old. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'd also like to compliment Tammy Denny for all her hard work on this issue. She's put a lot of time into this. Interstate or intrastate, it's even hard to enunciate, much less apply. When an agriculture producer is transporting grain from home storage to the grain elevator, is it interstate or intrastate transportation? When the producer is transporting strawberries from the field to the grocery store, is it interstate or intrastate transportation? Common sense tells you that the intrastate, can't get it right. The intrastate transportation is transporting the product to a location within the borders of the state. Interstate transportation would be transporting the product to a location outside the state. Unfortunately, the federal government doesn't operate on common sense. The issue raised in this bill has plagued the agriculture community for years, as Tammy indicated, but we've worked well with the Oregon Department of Transportation over the years, and it's simply been a problem that kind of lurked in the background. Recently, however, the federal agency made changes to their administrative rules that place Oregon in direct conflict on this issue. They are now enforcing a rule providing that if agriculture producer is transporting an agriculture product that ends up leaving the state, in other words, becomes interstate commerce, then the producer is conducting interstate commerce, even though the vehicle never leaves the state. The result is that the farm trucks become subject to additional unnecessary safety rules meant for interstate long-haul truckers. While this body cannot make the required changes necessary to remedy the problem, HJM 35 provides a way of expressing the sense of the Oregon Legislative Assembly to our congressional delegation that there is a problem and that there's also a reasonable solution. The Oregon Farm Bureau asks that you send HJM 35 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. I'd like to maybe make a clarification, or Representative Burley asked about the 150 miles. That's kind of a standard figure that's used. If you have a farm plate, you don't have to have a CDL, a commercial driver's license, if you're operating within 150 miles of your home place. If you go beyond the 150 miles, then you have to have a CDL. And so I think that was where the 150 miles come from. It's kind of a standard mileage figure that's used in those kinds of transportation issues.
Excuse me, Don. Sorry. Questions? Yes, Representative Booth.
It's more of a statement. I guess it still seems to me like it's an issue of fairness and definition. And if Oregon's the only one, it's like, how could they miss a whole state? And I could fully appreciate Tammy's comment on not wanting to call attention to anybody else, but it seems like intrastate, and that's just look it up in the dictionary. It means within the boundaries of the state, the borders.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else testify on House Joint Memorial 35? Close the public.
We had somebody moving.
Whoa. It's still open, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association. And I think I was asked to come up here to answer questions.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I was just curious about the application of this exemption and how widespread this interpretation of the intra versus interstate is.
What's happened is the Interstate Commerce Commission was disbanded back in 1995, and the remnants of the ICC were moved into the U.S. Department of Transportation. Back in the old days when the ICC was in existence, the movement that the wheat growers are talking about, where the farm truck takes it to a grain elevator, that would have been considered intrastate. There was a leading case in Florida, Chevron Oil Company, and it was basically the same kind of situation. And they were moving oil products into a big tank farm. And what the ICC said, they didn't know where that oil was going to go from there. It could go interstate, but it was just as likely that it would be intrastate. So that original movement, moving the oil into the tank farm, was considered to be intrastate. So under the ICC, the wheat growers moving to the grain silos would have been considered intrastate, and it would not have been an issue. But since the ICC has been disbanded, the U.S. DOT has expanded that definition, sweeping them into the interstate regulations. And that's happened since 1995. So that's really what's going on, what's caused this problem.
Yes, certainly.
So, as another example, if we have log trucks here in Oregon that, you know, haul from the woods to Prineville, they could be hauling somewhere else to either export logs or who knows where the lumber's going. I mean, do they fall under the same problems?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, absolutely. If they're hauling logs for export to Coos Bay or to Fort Portland, because the intent clearly is for those logs to move in foreign or interstate commerce, that's interstate. And log truckers are brought under the interstate regulations in those cases.
Further questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could just make a statement. This, in many respects, this kind of defies logic in my simple view of things, and I wholeheartedly support what the Wheat Growers and Farm Bureau is trying to do here, but I guess maybe the question is this a is the scope of this problem a little bit larger. And also, if I'm not mistaken, the U.S. House of Representatives recently passed out the transportation bill, if I'm not mistaken. Is there any language in there, to your knowledge, that deals with this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, there is an exemption in the House version of the reauthorization bill for agriculture. Now, I have not read it, so I don't know how it's defined and how broad it is. But I know it is, there is an exemption for transportation of agricultural commodities from the federal safety regulations. And which regulations, I don't know. And if there's any mileage limitation, I don't know that either.
Thank you. Further questions? Thanks, Bob. Okay.
Could we ask her to come back up again?
Tammy?
Yeah.
Tammy, you want to come back up for a minute?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think I could answer that question that you just posed. The exemption that I'm aware of is pertinent to hours of service. That was what has been incorporated in that most recent iteration of the transportation bill.
Okay, so it wouldn't include the other...
Correct.
Requirements of
Correct.
Interstate. Okay. Good. That's helpful. Thank you.
That's my understanding at this moment in time. And I wish beyond all belief that it had, but it did not. So
Thank you.
Okay. Now we'll close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 35 and open the work session on House Joint Memorial 35.
Mr. Chair. I would move that we pass HJM 35 to the House floor with a due adopt recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Hunt moves House Joint Memorial 35 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Discussion. Mike, call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative
Boone?
Aye.
Representative
Burley?
Aye.
Representative
Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair
Gilman? Aye. Motion carries. Volunteer to carry it? Yeah, Representative Thatcher. Fine. Okay. We'll open a work session on 2742. Patrick, we've got some amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2742, first heard on April 8th. This bill establishes a Safe Routes to Schools Fund, requires the State Department of Transportation to establish Safe Routes to Schools program, authorizes ODOT to apply for, accept, receive, and disburse gifts, grants, and donations from the federal government or any other sources, which would be placed into the fund. It provides assistance to local communities to eliminate hazards and barriers to children walking or biking to and from school, and can include grants, technical services, and advice and evaluation. Included in your packets, you'll find the -1 amendments to this bill, and also you'll find the fiscal analysis of the -1 amendments. Don't let me mention here at all.
Yes.
Okay. At the request of the chair, I sent a letter to the speaker's office to request permission to rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and we were approved to do so, if it is the committee's desire to do it.
Okay. Any, know that I need any testimony. Representative Burley, do you have anything you want to weigh in on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. After the hearing that we had in Bend and discussion and whatnot, I spent quite a bit of time with both Troy from ODOT and Scott Bricker discussing this. We've got some of the concerns laid out and tried a couple of amendments, spent quite a bit of time on the phone with LC and came up with this -1 amendment that I believe everybody's in agreement with. Scott's not here, but I think we've got this thing pretty well nailed down. Everybody's satisfied, so I certainly appreciate your consideration.
Good. Well, I think the first motion would be in order would be to before we do the referral.
Yes, I think.
Okay. Then
open to a -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt a -1 amendment to House Bill 2742.
Representative Verley moves -1 amendments to 2742. Any discussion? Any opposition? Adopted.
And Mr. Chair, I move that we refer House Bill 2742 as amended by a -1 amendments to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Oops, one minute. I'd like to restate that, okay? Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Burley moves 2742 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation and moves to rescind the referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any? Cool. Michael, call the roll.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative
Burley?
Aye.
Representative
Thatcher?
I am now an aye.
Representative
Byers?
Aye.
Chair Gilman? Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Burley, I'm assuming you'd like to carry this.
I'd be delighted to. Thank you.
Okay. Open a work session on 2811. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2811, we heard on April 4th and on Monday. On Monday, we had before us a few sets of amendments, and at that time there was some discussion that that an additional word inserted into the amendments was necessary, which has led to the production of the -8 amendments, which I believe should be in front of everybody. They were put on top of your pile. Here you go.
Thank you.
These amendments are the, well, by their number, -8 is indicative that they are the result of much work on this subject. I believe it is Mark Lander here. Mark Lander will be available to speak to the amendments if the committee so chooses.
Okay. Okay. Mark, you want to come up for just a minute, or rather not? Stay there unless we get somebody to ask you to come up. Okay. All right, Mr. Committee, I think we're ready for a motion.
Were you going to make a motion?
I was.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's perfect.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the -8 amendment to House Bill 2811.
Representative Bruin moves the -8 amendments to 2811. Any discussion? Any opposition? 2811 is amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2811 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bruin moves 2811 to the House floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Michael.
Representative
Burley?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Byers?
Aye.
Chair Gilman? Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Broom, I'm assuming you're going to carry the bill.
I would be happy to do so.
Thank you. Okay. We'll open a work session on
3024. I'll get it. That's one. 3024. Thanks, Mr. Chair. This bill in original form, I apologize. I should let you know that this bill in original form never received a public hearing. That being said, I believe for the purposes of this meeting, we can open as a work session. We do not have it scheduled to open as a public hearing, but we can open it as a work session because the committee is planning to move it to another committee, and so as a result, we can probably do that.
Okay. Okay. Yes, we didn't have a hearing. That's right.
Yes, the original bill has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue. However, you'll find in your packets beneath the staff measure summary dash one amendments, which were, are submitted by the Department of Transportation. I believe they will come up to speak to those amendments. And they have suggested that those amendments would be more appropriate for discussion by a budget committee. And as a result, I submitted at the chair's direction a letter to the speaker requesting that the referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded and that the committee and that the bill be referred instead to the Committee on Budget. And we were approved to do that.
Good.
All right. Joan, do you want to? Oh, okay.
Come on up.
I think if it was just kind of giving out. As long as we're willing to take any testimony, that would be okay.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marston, the Department of Transportation, here to present on House Bill 3024. And as Patrick indicated, the bill, as introduced, would deal with lottery bonds and transportation projects. If the dash one amendments are approved, it would delete that original language and allow us to remove a sunset clause for expenditure of modernization dollars. What that means is that it would repeal the current sunset and allow the current statute to remain in effect that says state and federal dollars can be used to meet the statutory direction about the amount of funds that are spent on highway modernization expenditures. The legislature funded a state modernization program in 1987 using tax and fee increases from that session and the prior session and used statutory language to designate the amount that can be or must be used for modernization and said that the 50% share of revenue raised by 4 cents of gas tax and equivalent truck fees must go towards modernization, and that amount is about $51 million per year. We call that the minimum mod requirement or minimum modernization. Until 2001, we counted only the state dollars. With that provision in 2001, though, we were able to count state and federal dollars as meeting the requirement, and the sunset provision would go into effect in 2006 and eliminate the requirement. By allowing us to continue to use that, it allows us to make sure we make the best use of federal and state resources. There are a lot of issues about when federal dollars come in, to be able to apply them to an expenditure in the way that's the most effective. Also allows us to continue the use of the local fund exchange program where we can work with local governments to have them exchange federal dollars to us so that they can use a less complex process of going through their highway project work instead of having to use the federal requirements. So they can use the work with the state rather than the federal on the requirements. And in addition, it allows us to make sure that we're using matching funds better in the state and therefore doing a better job of using up all federal dollars that come into the state as well as using up dollars that come into local governments. So this provision would allow us to ensure that we're managing the capacity of the system. We understand the importance of modernization and dealing with capacity. We want to make sure that we're spending the money on modernization. At the same time, all the other elements of the budget, operations, safety, et cetera, are also critical to the state's economy. We want to make sure all those elements are spent and doing what the legislature has approved, which is why sending this to Ways and Means, where they will look at our appropriation and make the decisions about how much is appropriated with state dollars and federal dollars is appropriate. On the handout to the chair and members, it lists the modernization funds that have been spent in the current biennium, last biennium, and proposed for next biennium. As you can see, the amount has not gone down. It's certainly our intent to maintain the importance of modernization funds, and Mr. Chair, this amendment would ensure that the sunset clause is removed and allows us to make sure that we can get money spent timely, work within the federal requirements in order to get state dollars used where appropriate and federal dollars used where appropriate without having to put them into inappropriate silos of expenditure. We're open to any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Mike. Questions? We may have locked out. Let's wait for a minute. Are you all right? Is your question? Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else to testify on House Bill 3024? Okay, we're still in work session. We need to move this to the House budget.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes.
So I would like to move House. Oh, wait a minute. We have to adopt the dash one amendment.
Oh, we got to do the dash one first.
I move to adopt the dash one amendment to House Bill 3024.
Representative Burley
moves the dash one amendments to 3024. Any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3024 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation, rescind referral to revenue, and refer bill to House Committee on Budget.
Okay. Representative Burley moves 3024 as amended to the House Committee on Budget with a do pass recommendation.
Rescind referral to revenue.
Oh, and rescinds the referral to revenue. Any discussion? Michael?
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative
Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative
Byer?
Aye.
Representative
Jones?
Aye.
Representative
Gillum? Aye.
Chair
Gillum? Aye. Motion carries. And I'll open the work session on 3252.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3252, we heard originally on April 18th. It's the bill that establishes speed limits for rural interstate highways. Attached in your packets, you will find the dash one amendment. That is a replacement of the bill, and it's, I believe, this is my summary of it based upon just brief reading, but correct me if I'm wrong. The amendment stipulates that if the Department of Transportation designates speeds greater than 65 miles per hour, the designated speed for vehicles which are described in 811.111, which include trucks, school buses, etc., must be at least 5 miles per hour lower than the designated speed for all other vehicles. The current law, I believe, says no more than 5 miles.
Right. Pretty simple little amendment. And the purpose is to give the department and the Transportation Commission the ability to maintain that 10-mile differential if they so choose when and if they go to 70 miles an hour on rural interstates. Any questions, comments? Representative Hunt, you have perplexed your look.
Well, because I'm not sure the question is. I'm looking out at the table, and I'm not sure the question is for anyone here. I mean, based on the safety. I mean, obviously, this dramatically changes the intent of the original bill. We have safety concerns expressed about the original bill. Do we have a sense from law enforcement or other safety officials about their perspective with this pretty significant change from the original bill?
I haven't gotten any information along that line. I have heard that there's just about as many studies that show that the differential, no differential, 5 miles or 10 miles, that they all have varying views on whether there's more collisions or less.
If I could follow up.
Yes.
Is there any, I don't know if there's anyone here from the department or otherwise that
Troy
haven't thought on that?
Troy shaking
his head. Fair enough.
I think he's coming up. He doesn't, that means he doesn't want to come up, but he's coming.
I think they flipped the coin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And, Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, I think your question is relating to the differential, whether it's 0 or 5 or 10. Different people can come to this table and present to you a study that supports every one of those positions as being safer than the other. There was an attempt in the Midwest recently to do a study to try and put an end to all of the different discussions about what was better than the other, and it just raised even more questions. California is 15, 70 miles an hour for cars and 55 for trucks. Washington is 10, Idaho is 10. There are Midwest states that are equal. They're 75-75 for cars and for trucks. So you can literally cherry-pick the conversation and come up with a set of information that will support whatever stand you want to make on that particular piece.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have, I mean, obviously this change would make it at least five, so the department would have no authority to lessen the gap, less than five. I mean, do you have any sense at all? I mean, theoretically, under this language, as I read it, you could make the gap 20 miles an hour. I assume that there's not a desire to do that. I mean, maybe you can give us some guidance. If this passes, what's the likely high-end gap? Gap is maybe not the terminology, but the range. Yeah, I guess it is a gap between trucks and passenger vehicles likely to be.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt, the differential between the two speeds, this is only going to apply if the interstate for passenger cars is posted at 70. Then the differential would come into play. And the options usually don't post anything other than on 5 mile an hour increments just for readability and consistency sake. That would either be 60 or 55 for trucks and buses as called out in statute, because there already is a 55 limit elsewhere. So it's only applying if you were to see passenger cars at 70, not universal everywhere else.
Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Comment. Actually, also what the Dash 1 amendment does is it addresses the concern that you brought up during the testimony before about the way the bill was drafted originally. You had no flexibility in certain areas, for example, down the Siskiyou's, to post less than 70 when the conditions truly warrant something like that.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, that is correct. This leaves the discretion back with the department and the commission in relationship to geography or other issues. Toyota Curves is another one, even though it's urban setting, but it allows the lower posting.
Further questions or discussion? I just passed to Representative Burley a memo from the department, from engineers in the department, indicating that very well, if there had been a 10-mile differential available when they did the study, they very well may have gone to 70 miles an hour for cars. And that's the main reason for this. And they can make it 8 miles. I mean, that's, or six. But.
Do you want to say something? You're looking right at me.
I think it's probably appropriate. You say so.
Okay, well, as wife of the president of the Leadfoot Society, who testified before us the other day, full member apparently. No, actually, I think it's. I don't think you need a paper survey. You just go down the road. Go down the interstate. I think people have made their wishes known. I mean, raising it to 70 is not going to change behavior all that much. I mean, if it does, it won't. It'll just be, people won't have to be looking over their shoulders. It's essentially, they'll be driving the speed limit. And
And if you'll recall, on when we had discussions, they said, well, if we raise it to 70, well, then everybody will drive 75. Well, maybe, but.
Well, there's studies that show that that's not the case. That was
I challenge that. I really think that that may not be the case. I think I'm ready for a motion on the dash twos or dash ones.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3252.
Representative Thatcher moves the dash one amendments to 3252. Any discussion? Any opposition?
Oh, Mr. Chair, you're looking at me again. I move House Bill 3252 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves 3252 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion? Representative Boone.
Well, I will be a no on this, as you well would guess, for reasons stated during the hearings, and it's just a maybe it's my personal conviction that I don't believe that putting the speed limit up any faster is going to keep people at that level. I think they'll just keep going faster if they can. But that's I don't think that my vote's going to keep it from going to the floor.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Any other comments from Representative Blunt?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I frankly am kind of undecided. On the original bill, I had a clear understanding, and we've had lots of testimony really focused on just the issue of speeds, not really much on the differential at all. So I guess I'm planning to use the time between now and the floor vote on this to talk to some of the folks on the speed zone panel again and come to a clearer conclusion for myself. So I understand the need to move it today, and I just want to let you know I will be setting this on its way to the floor and make a firmer conclusion then.
That's fine. Not a problem, Mr. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of the same concerns that Representative Boone addressed, as well as Representative Hunt. I'm in a position that my predecessor in my district was worked hard and was a big proponent of this, and I have a lot of respect for the work he put into this. I'm going to vote yes today, but I have concerns that hopefully can be addressed between now and the time this reaches the floor as well, that even though this opens the way for ODOT to raise the speed limits, it's not considered or construed by ODOT to be a mandate to raise speed limits. Safety still has to be the absolute number one criterion above and beyond what the legislature wants to see. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this also, I guess, came as a surprise to me, and I had been prepared when I saw this on the agenda to be a no vote, although I did support the original bill in 2003. And so right now, I think I'm going to go ahead and support it, and I do reserve the right to change my vote on the floor after I think about it for a while.
The chair really understands that, and it will not be bothered. And it's not a there was a note here somewhere. Is this a priority? And this is not a priority of mine. I just want actually what I want to do is to give the department and the commission as much latitude as I can to set speed zones or speeds at the best rate, considering safety, and I think we all agree safety is still the number one issue. Okay, I think we're ready for a vote, Mike.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
No.
Representative Berwin?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carried. Do you want to carry it, or do you want me to carry it, or?
I'd be happy to, sure.
All right. Representative Thatcher will carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, yes. It's my first, that this is monumental. It's my first no vote in committee.
Defining moment.
Even in my health committee, yes.
Could we say you're slow?
If you want to know something else, it was my first no vote on the floor today, too.
All right, we'll open a work session on 3415, and Patrick, we've got a whole bunch of amendments. And
yes, Mr. Chair.
Help us through this a little bit.
I will do my best. House Bill 3415, we heard on the 25th of April. It's a bill that requires that bond proceeds earmarked for replacement of or repair of bridges, but not spent by ODOT, be instead spent on highway projects of statewide significance. The measure has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. You'll see I've written up on the staff measure summary a write-up of the -4 amendments, which flip that requirement that bond proceeds earmarked for bridge replacement but not spent would instead be spent on, and then it breaks that out into three groups: 50% for highway projects of statewide significance, 25% for transportation projects under 367-800 to 367-824, and 25% for freight projects considered by the Freight Advisory Committee under Section 11.1, Sub 1, Sub A, Chapter 618, Oregon Laws 2003. Since that time, I have also received dash 2 amendments, which are very similar to the dash 4s in that they break it out into two parts, 75% for a project of statewide significance and 25% for the transportation projects on 367-800-824. That's the dash 2s. The dash 5s break it down also 75% for statewide significance and 25% for the ones that were projects considered by the Freight Advisory Committee under the Oregon Laws 2003, Chapter 618. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe these originated with Representative Hunt's office, or at least some of them did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just by way, I mean, as we're looking at this, there are really three categories that I think we brought forward, three amendments, so there's some clear policy choices that are mutually exclusive and don't require any conceptual amendments. I think the projects of statewide significance piece is the clearest. That's the one we heard the testimony about. These are key freight routes in the state that the Transportation Commission has highlighted as significant. We heard testimony on them. They unfortunately, although they're on the designated list, they really have almost no money identified for them, so a clear financial need. And I think also we heard testimony, and I've subsequently heard from several folks, that the fact that the Department of Transportation will know by the end of this year exactly how much will be saved by applying the OSU studies to the bridges. They'll know by the end of this year, as Director Warner told us at the hearing, how much will be applied, which gives a real opportunity for these projects to get some funding committed and actually make a lot of progress moving forward, as opposed to waiting a couple of years until we're next in session. The other two categories, in great language that legislative council loves to write, maybe let me just give a little clarity to what they actually are. The funding transportation projects under ORS 367-800-824, that's the innovative partnership program, the public-private partnerships that were authorized by the legislature in 2003. ODOT has actually just begun to request for proposal process on that, so we really have no idea which RFPs are going to come back, which are going to be adopted, and how those are going to go forward. But that's a program. So when it refers to that section, it would be funding projects under those innovative partnerships. The other section then, freight projects that the Freight Advisory Committee considered under that section of the state laws, that was the OTIA 3 process, projects that were considered by the commission. Applicants that were made, I believe there were just over 200 projects that remain on that list. They prioritized the ones that were, as I understand it, you know, key freight highway projects, as well as those that were in the worst shape, and got those done. But there's obviously there are projects that remain on that. Some of them just because there wasn't enough money, others perhaps because they didn't meet the key freight route test. So looking at the three categories, we've got three or four ways, even with the base bill. My personal bias would obviously be the base bill to have 100% go to statewide significance. I think there's a case that's been made in terms of setting aside some of the money for these freight projects that the Freight Advisory Committee considered but were not funded, which if you look at the list and the department has the list, it's a fairly significant list of projects all over the state. This wouldn't tell them which ones to fund. This would say there's a pot of money that's 25% of whatever is saved, again, which is an unknown, but probably 150 million, 200 million, 300 million, we don't know. We'll know by the end of the year. So my personal bias would be to at least protect 75% of the money for the projects of statewide significance, and to do which would be the dash fives then, to set aside 25% that could be utilized for those other freight projects. And Representative Thatcher pointed out a good thing when I was talking with her earlier. Although it says, if you look at the dash fives in line 10, it says 25% for freight projects. All of these are highway projects. These are not rail projects. These aren't marine projects. These aren't projects that are going to be funded under Connect Oregon. So it doesn't say highway freight projects, but in fact, I think ODOT will acknowledge everything on that list is a highway project. This legislation is the perfect supplement to Connect Oregon. It's really the one thing we can do of great significance this session for key highway freight projects. Connect Oregon will do the same thing on the marine rail aviation side. If you're open to a motion for sake of discussion, perhaps, I will...
Let me see if I have a little more discussion. If we don't, then we'll see. Any more discussion on this?
Well, Representative Hunt and I talked earlier, and I was, too, leaning towards, 100% towards projects of statewide significance, but I do see a case for at least allowing for these freight routes to be upgraded and that wouldn't otherwise be covered, help give some funding to those. I think there's a good case for that as well. That would be the Dash 5s.
Dash 5.
I believe so. Isn't that right, Representative Hunt? Oh, sorry.
Representative Hunt.
And I just wanted a point of clarification. Maybe someone from ODOT can help me on this. Because I'm inclined to choose the Dash 5s also, because if Senate Bill 894 is truly dead, the freight route bill, and Senate Bill 555 is the only bill that's left regarding the highways there, and I've been told that if a highway is not designated as a freight route, they're lowered priority for modernization monies. Is that right?
I'm
looking for just a little.
Joan's going to do it. Oh, book on a book.
Let me just tell you a little bit of. I got a heads up in an email and another phone call from Tillamook County commissioners. They've all come out. Tillamook, Clatsop, and the Northwest Act. Everybody's come out against 894 in the terms of how it was running as a freight route. And then they said, and I said, well, you know, you'll lose the opportunity to be picking up some extra money for modernization if you are a freight route. And they continued to say, oh, no, we don't want it. But the other bill, the replacement bill, Senate 555, that sets apart part of Highway 101 and 126. Yesterday I get these emails and phones saying that the Northwest Act met, and that was corroborated by the department. And so now some of these people are rethinking it, because they're thinking, well, if we don't have a freight, if we're not designated as a freight route, we won't get any of these extra money. So all that said, would this bill amended with the Dash 5s allow them to qualify for some of those funds if Senate Bill 555 goes through?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joan Plank with the Department of Transportation, I don't see that this bill would change. I think it was actually Senate Bill 566 was the one that,
you're right.
Okay, that passed out of the Senate, which said that a couple of highway segments, one east, Highway 26 east of, Highway 26 or 126 east of Springfield, and then the north 101 from Florence through Astoria would not be designated freight routes, and that was the choice that those communities had made and requested that be included in the bill. I was party to the emails that I think you're referring to, Representative Boone, where they were looking for clarification about whether or not they would qualify for money for their system, and they still would qualify. We'll still spend money on those highways, but again, House Bill 2041 from last session said that freight routes and freight projects would get priority or would be considered important in terms of funding. So it's not that they won't get any funding, it's just that they won't probably rank as high in terms of if they're not a designated freight route.
Because of follow-up, because this Dash 5 only addresses freight projects. Is that right?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, this just talks about the money that was going towards the freight projects last session, and so I suppose if there were any of those projects that were included on those highways, they could qualify under this. But
okay, thank you.
Okay.
Further questions?
Thanks.
Okay. Representative Hunt, I think I'm ready for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we adopt the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3415.
Representative Hunt moves the Dash 5 amendments to 3415. Any discussion? Mr. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose if I was looking at all of these things, and since and I'm never quite sure if you're going to oppose a bill, whether it makes any difference if you vote for the amendments or not, but I guess that since this bill is most likely going to go forward, I guess the Dash 5s are probably the better of the choices. But try as I might, I can't get to support the bill in its entirety. And I think if we'd had the opportunity to have a broader discussion about all the places that this money could go if there was extra money, we always have lots of time down the road to do this in 2003. I'm going backwards and not forwards right now, but 2007, I just have a real problem identifying money before we have to. And so I'll support the amendments on the bill.
Further discussion? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you. I actually think Representative Byers' comments were almost prescient. I think if we had funded these highways of statewide significance in 2003, if we had actually allocated money for them, several of them would be far further along than they are today, and actually would be probably be constructed by the time we got back into session in 2007. There's no question that these projects will not be able to be completed by 2007. That's absolutely right. I think the question is if we give them some assurance of funding, if ODOT comes up with the clear recommendations of how much will be saved by the end of this year, they'll be able to allocate that money to these projects soon thereafter. And, you know, whether it's in any of these projects will be able to move forward in a substantive way, not just with the money they already have for EIS, but with further land acquisition, moving through the regulatory process, and really moving toward construction. So we should have done it in 2003, and I hope we do it now. And recognize this still doesn't solve the problem, because even if we pass this, it will still leave significant pieces of at least some of these projects to be funded in 2007.
Further discussion? All right. Done the motion. I think we're ready, Mike.
This is the amendment.
Is this the amendment?
Yes,
excuse me. Okay, thank you. Any further discussion on the amendment? Any opposition to the amendment? The amendment passes. We're voting on 3415-5. Discussion.
Oh, we have
to move the bill.
Oh, I got to have a motion. Somebody's got to make a motion. And we have to go to Ways and Means.
So help me understand, Mr. Chair, Patrick, the previous bill we just sent to the budget committee.
This, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, this bill has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and therefore that's where we'll send it. I believe the Speaker's office, or the Speaker has the authority to redirect it once we send it. We have to send it to the Committee on Ways and Means because that's the referral, but they, I believe, have the authority to redirect it to the Committee on Ways and Means. If that's what you're concerned. It's out of our agenda.
Do I hear funeral music now? It's going to be sent to Ways and Means.
No.
Okay.
That's some question of the concern.
I'll make the motion.
Mr. Chair, is there a way to make a motion that would request?
What?
Did you restart the phone?
No.
Bruce wants to stand on knees for a moment if you can.
Yep. We're standing.
Perfect time.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
I'm ready for a motion.
Yeah, right where you left off. My question was answered. Mr. Chair, I would move that we forward House Bill 3415 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Hunt moves that we move 3415-5 to the floor of the due pass recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment to Representative Hunt's, you know, statement about this gives them some assurance of, you know, that there might be some funding out there. And I'm not sure how we can give them assurance when we don't know that there's going to be funding out there and we don't know how much funding is going to be out there. So, and I know that I've heard great arguments about, you know, small pots being able to do right-of-way acquisition, that there are things that they can do, but I still, it's just kind of a bad precedent, I think, when you don't have to do it, to obligate future legislators.
Thank you. Further discussion. Mike, we're ready.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
No.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Berlin?
Aye.
Representative Berlin?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Chair Gellman?
Aye. Motion carries. I'm Representative Hunt. I'm assuming you'd like to carry this.
Be happy to, Mr. Chair.
All right. Anything else come before the committee?
Did you vote yes? No.
You put a no to the
committee is adjourned.
I think that was a no. I think yeah.